Welcome to the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including the Voight-Kampff test. I am Daniel Winter.
Hello, and I'm Mark Yuasa.
How are you today, Mark?
I am well, yeah. Sunday night, had a good weekend. Yeah, pretty good.
Excellent. Yeah, been a quiet week for games here as I start ramping up for Terminal City Tabletop Convention in a couple of weeks here in Vancouver. So I've been helping organize that. So hopefully to get some actual games in at the convention.
Yeah, and I got my tickets and I have signed up for a bunch of RPG sessions. So I'm looking forward to those.
Yeah, looking forward to comparing what we find there. For those who missed last episode, we have a new format here. Shall we just roll into that?
Yeah, for sure. I don't think there's a lot to explain. Basically, we're talking about two games, one each, for a little bit shorter than the last main game segment concept. And we're also talking about one brief topic each at the beginning, just something we're interested in, and then one off-topic subject each at the end. So Ironically, we're talking a lot about more things, but we're staying more on track.
Yes, trying to. No tangents.
Yeah, I think it's going well so far.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I'm enjoying this format. It lets us cover a wider range of games that wouldn't necessarily hold up to a full hour discussion. So, That said, shall we serve up an appetizer?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Yeah, so this is where we just each bring a little news item or game-related item that we've been enjoying. I have spoken many times lately about my love of physical media, and especially in games coverage and the various magazines that have been popping up. And a new one that just launched a couple of months ago is Tumulus? I'm not actually sure how you pronounce that. Not to be mistaken for Mr. Thomas. Tumulus, let's go with that. So this is from Exeunt Press, who I recently talked about. They published Exclusion Zone Botanist, along with many other sort of small-sized TTRPGs, a lot of solo games. They also have a blog, a design blog called Skeleton Code Machine, where they talk about just game design sort of philosophy, both in board games and TTRPGs. And also some reviews. And they recently launched this sort of quarterly periodical that they've been putting out. It's partly a sort of collection of some of their previous work with Skeleton Code Machine, but also some new work. And there's actually a really fascinating mix of material in here. In that there is like game reviews. There's one of Inhuman Conditions, the one where you're basically having to run the Voight-Kampff test against each other to determine, like through logic puzzles, to determine if the other player is a robot or not. You've got some analyses of the genre of betrayal mechanics, basically, throughout both board games and TTRPGs, and how that sort of compares in those two sort of subgenres. You've got some just random tables that you might want to use for your TTRPGs. This first issue being all sort of cyberpunk, android themed. So you've got tables for mega corporations, for android names. There's a mini game in there that you can use to generate a sort of a city or a segment of city blocks for a sort of cyberpunk themed game, and all the factions that are going to be running the different blocks. One thing I did find particularly interesting in here was there was an article on hex flowers. Is that, if that's something you're familiar with, Mark?
No, I can't say I've heard about hex flowers.
Because we have hex maps where you're basically exploring or using that to generate some sort of setting or resources as you expand in a TTRPG. But hex flowers basically being a way that you can stack the odds a little bit and sort of funnel the odds into an inevitable outcome, or just stack the odds in some way. And so, and there was an article talking about how you can utilize that in game design, for example. So I found that quite fascinating. Really interesting mix of material here. In full disclosure, they did send me this copy to have a look at myself, and I'll pass this along to you to have a browse through as well. I think the second issue is out or in the process of being put out. I don't remember what the theme for that was, but this first one is all cyberpunk. So if you have any interest in that theme for TTRPGs especially, there's some bound to be some useful material here, but there's also other board game and sort of mini game material as well. It's a fun read.
Very cool. I am Very much looking forward to reading that. Cyberpunk is one of my favorite genres.
Yes.
I'm actually reading a Shadowrun novel right now, the third in the Secrets of Power trilogy, which is like written way back.
Oh, actual novel, is it?
Yeah, that's right. It's okay. Officially based on the license. Oh. And it came out when the first edition of the RPG did. And there's been something like 50 novels or something written in Shadowrun. Oh, wow. Universe. So it's a bit interesting. Some of the concepts are pretty dated, as you might imagine, technology wise and sort of cultural yep. sensitivity perspective as well. But it's sort of fascinating looking through a lens and into a different time, quite literally. So I will gladly read that issue.
Excellent. So what are you serving up today, Mark?
Yeah, my game-related amuse-bouche is something of another podcast episode that I just listened to. I don't know if it's the latest episode, but it's part of a podcast I've listened to for years, the Ludology podcast. They had a short format episode.
Mm.
They've been experimenting with slightly different formats and different material on their podcast recently, and it's called Thinking Beyond Mechanisms, episode 16, and this is just like a 6-minute brief mini episode. Hosts Sen and Erica had a guest host on Sarah Shipp, and they discussed the concepts of prompts and how that affected creativity. And I thought that was really interesting based on games that we've been discussing recently. We talked about the solo TTRPG Transformation, which I played the other day.
Mm.
Their main thesis was that players have a tendency to shut down if they're presented with absolute freedom.
Yep.
Maybe you're familiar with this.
Oh, yes. All too well.
Tabletop RPGs. Everyone's been through this, right? Mm. Everyone around the table is like, what should we do? What should we do? We talk about the plan for the entire session without getting into the action. So their thesis was that basically players do better if you present them with boundaries to what of the potential. So those forms of boundaries could be giving them flipping cards, like something like Dixit or Cards mm-hmm. Against Humanity, right? It's not absolute freedom, but you have freedom within these dozen or so options that you're presented with. And that made me think, yeah, that's absolutely true. If I was told, how would I write about my life as a 1,000-year-old vampire? I would have a very hard time doing that. But if the book gave me mechanism like rolling dice or flipping cards gave me constraints and prompts within which I could use to ply my creativity, then that's a much easier to use on-ramp to creative output.
Yeah, it really creates an excellent seed to sort of latch on to and let your creativity sort of bloom from there. And I'd avoided TTRPGs and even solo ones for quite some time. It's only in the last year that I'd started to explore that and found those prompts surprisingly useful just to start writing something, and then it sort of snowballs from there, right? And it was a fascinating podcast. I did, as Sarah pointed out, is a really a broad sort of spectrum of prompts and how in depth they can be. I mean, you've got sort of Cards Against Humanity, Apples to Apples. It's basically the prompt is the game, right? It never goes any deeper than that. It's just Mad Libs, basically, all the way up to like a solo TTRPG where one word or one phrase might be triggering a whole paragraph of text or a performance in some sort of party games.
Yeah, I thought the connection was really quite accurate and relevant to stuff we've been looking at recently. Mm. Of course, we're getting into more solo TTRPGs, and it just seemed like it made perfect sense. So I think no one has an excuse. It's only 6 minutes long. It's free. Go out there and check it right now. It's a thought-provoking mini episode, and just shows that Ludology continues to put out great work.
Yeah, one particularly interesting point that she made was that even prompts can trigger a sort of sense of paralysis in trying to come up with the perfect response to that, and how time limits or other restrictions can be a really useful tool to sort of force people to just come up, just have something, just get something on the table and move along rather than trying to make this sort of perfect response and just keep the game moving.
Yeah, it's really important to think about, because I like to think of myself as a creative person, but I've been sort of struggling with producing creative output for a long time. And it's interesting to see how little of a push you really need to get, you know, fresh ideas to flow. So there's really lots of inspirational material out there, like flipping those dice, like tarot cards. We talked about the world building game Dekuma the other day, and there's just so many tools out there. And I think that's like one of the kind of more powerful developments coming out of TTRPGs of late and games of late.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you go. So that's all I wanted to talk about. Go check that out. It's very thought-provoking stuff.
Well, I hope those two offerings whetted your appetite. We'll drop the links to both of those in the show notes. Shall we get to the main course, Mark?
Absolutely. Someone right here is peckish.
Oh, quite hungry, yes.
Let's begin. All right, okay. Do you want to start us off?
Sure, let's do that. So my offering today is I wanted to talk about Stalker 2, Heart of Chernobyl. So this is sequel to the Stalker series. The first game came out, I think, 2007. And it was three games in pretty short succession up through 2009. But this is the fourth game in the series, but the first one since 2009. So it's been quite a ways since the last game. This is developed and published by GSC Game World, directed by Yevgen and Maria Grigorovich. So, yeah, this game came out in November last year, I think it was. And I've been picking at it a little bit since then, between other games and family and holiday commitments, and struggling a little bit to sort of really get into it. It's a pretty rocky start and sort of really understanding what's going on. But in the last couple of weeks, I really started to get it and lean into it a little more. So I've been playing quite a bit of it these last couple of weeks. Mark, are you familiar with the Stalker series at all?
I'm only familiar with it from reputation. I know that it's sort of a Russian language based game. I believe it's by Eastern European developers.
Ukrainian, to be specific.
Yeah. Yes. Ukrainian developers, and that it sort of has like a cult following and kind of like it features pretty intense gameplay.
Yes. Yeah. So this is obviously based on there's the movie Stalker, but it's probably what more in common with the original book called Roadside Picnic. I've spoken before about my love of sort of zone media, Exclusion Zone Botanist, which I just mentioned, Pacific Drive that we played last year as a featured game. And so, yeah, I really love those settings. This really gamifies those settings quite explicitly in the exploring an open world and the various anomalies that have spawned around it. In some interesting ways, like some of these anomalies are very subtle in that you might just see a slight shimmer, like in some part of the landscape, like a shimmering orb, or you're walking around and suddenly you're a face full of floating glass shards that is a whole field floating in the air that you didn't see. Other times it's just like a giant flaming ball or a ball of electricity bouncing around. So not the most subtle. I will say I do tend to prefer part of the beauty of this genre I've found is just like the terror of an empty field and what you can't see, what you can't comprehend. One of the tropes in this game is you've got bolts that you throw the anomalies to sort of trigger them or detect them. And that, partly that originally came up in Roadside Picnic because you can't see, like, it might just be a regular stretch of road that will tear you apart if you happen to walk through it. There is no way of detecting it without having some sort of way of probing this. And so this game makes that more explicit, obviously, with being able to see most of these. So it's a little less subtle in that regard, but there is a lot of beauty to be found here just in roaming the countryside. Even between anomalies, you're just walking along these sort of barren, abandoned, sort of post-apocalyptic worlds, and just the weather effects are incredibly beautiful. Both the rain, the storms, you've got debris flying sideways and the lightning bolts striking down everywhere, and incredibly visceral weather in this game. There's emissions, I think they're called. They're basically, I've only experienced like three of them in 10 hours of play, but basically an emission is coming, everyone get indoors. If you're outside, you will instantly die, basically. And when this happens, the entire sky turns like crimson red, and it's like everything is depicted in these sort of silhouettes really strikingly. And everyone, bandits, stalkers, everyone is rushing to the nearest building and huddling up together. So, yeah, really, really striking sense of weather and location and place in this game.
That sounds a lot like those missions in Pacific Drive when you've captured the doodad or whatever.
Yeah.
And the storm comes bearing down on you and you just have to escape the area to survive with your vehicle intact.
Well, the thing that the one that was brought to mind for me was PUBG, which I only played a little bit of, only playing solo, but because as I was learning that game, I was the type who would just find a homestead, hide inside the bathtub, like as soon as I see another person, and just spend 10 minutes huddling in the bathtub, hoping that no one sees me and that I might win by happenstance. So I didn't play that game for very long, suffice to say. But this did bring back those memories and that tension in a really satisfying way, obviously, with especially with those storms coming in. So combat-wise, I don't play many first-person shooters these days, to be honest, but at least not one of the many of the sort of popular ones like Call of Duty that are very precision military focused. But this definitely has that feel, very tight shooting. Fighting human enemies in the game is incredibly lethal. Like, you'll just be wandering around the countryside, you'll come across a group of bandits that you might stumble into because the foliage is so dense that suddenly there's five bandits in your face, and as soon as they start shooting at you, you're basically going down. As soon as something spots you and is trying to kill you, it's probably too late. So you need to be constantly trying to find cover, or just knowing where your nearest cover is in this game. But if you can get the drop on enemies, you are also very lethal in that, like, single headshots will take down any human enemy, and it's incredibly satisfying to just pop off four bandits in quick succession and be on the run to cover before the mutants arrive. So I did find that very satisfying. Fighting the other creatures and the mutants, not so satisfying. I've only seen like three or four types of mutants, and most of them are just huge bullet sponges, like these giant boars and giant various hulking beasts that will wander around in packs and will just attack you, and will charge you faster than you can dodge out of the way. And it's just it's just an exercise in attrition, basically, in whether you can shoot them down.
So I'm hearing from you that there's certain degree of PvP and then PvE elements.
Well, not PvP. Like, it's all NPC humans, I should say.
Okay, so what is the ultimate goal of what you're doing?
It's hard to say, because you've gone into the zone with a MacGuffin to what's called the scanner, the scanning device that can recharge artifacts. These artifacts will spawn. They give you some sort of mild benefits, like increasing your carry weight or increasing your resistance to fire, and the scanner can recharge those. But something goes bad, it gets stolen from you, and you're trying to recover it. It's like, oh well, the last guy who has seen the people who took it was Richter. Okay, I'll go talk to Richter. Okay, he says the last person to have seen them was this other guy called Varric. Okay, I'll go talk to Varric. Oh, he says the last people to have seen them was this other, like, is this chain of dudes? You're just being sent from dude to dude to dude to dude.
The princess is in another castle.
Basically, and like, I have very little context for who any of these people are. You've not really got any time to get to know them, or they're all parts of different factions, but they all look the same. There's not really much in terms of distinction between these various factions of bandits and stalkers and military forces. And like, if you see a group of five people wandering around the countryside, you've got no real way of knowing if they're good or bad until they're close enough to shoot you, basically. And so it's a little strange in that regard. I don't really have a good sense of who these people are or why they're here. I think some of that probably comes from the previous games. But when you are in combat, it is fun. But I don't have a good sense of what I'm doing, who these people are, why they like, why are you in the zone? I know, like, originally the idea was you want to get to the center of the zone and it will fulfill your wish. But that's apparently out of, like, that's been resolved. Like, whatever, the wish granter is gone in this setting, is all I've heard. And so I don't know why these people are here, to be honest. They're not really doing much other than surviving. There's not much to be gained in staying in the zone from what I've seen so far. So,
right. Yeah. So is there like an arc that you're developing towards? Because, you know, I know what the arc in Pacific Rim is to, you know, soup up your car and unlock new technology and, you know, find out probably what is the cause and of this anomaly, and to learn the history of these characters. Like, is there anything directing you towards
sort
of goal?
I have been introduced to a couple of larger factions that it's starting to make me force me to make choices as to who I'm going to side with. And the game is surprisingly dynamic in how you do that. Like, there's a very early quest where you have to side with the local stalkers or side with the military group. And if you try to play both sides and go and talk to one group and then go talk to the other group, they'll know that. It's like, hey, like, we know who you're talking to. Like, the game keeps track of that in a surprisingly dynamic way. There's at one point where a bandit leader asks you to go and kill two other bandit leaders, or kill one of the two for him to sort of shake things up. And I've got no point of reference for who they are, but what the game doesn't tell you is you can just shoot him there on the spot and be done with that whole side quest. And it's very flexible in that you can just, it's very cutthroat. And it does force you into this mindset of kill or be killed, basically. But yeah, grand story-wise, it's funneling me into a couple of larger factions and story beats. It is starting to go places. I am starting to finally track down the scanner, I think. But again, it's just been ping-ponging between fetch quests of different dudes so far. That it's fun, like wandering the countryside, but I have very little context for what it is I'm doing.
I see. And do you think you'll continue playing?
Yeah, I mean, it is satisfying. Just the being in the world is incredibly satisfying. And I'm hoping to get a little more context as I get deeper in. But yeah, there is a lot of issues. I would have liked some more fleshing out of some of the mechanics. To get to the elephant in the room here, it is by a Ukrainian developer. The game has had various development issues over its sort of been in production for 15 years or so, but not the least of which, of course, is Ukraine being invaded by Russia, which is ongoing and has affected the developer in quite explicit ways. There's various staff members had gone on to fight and died in the war over there, which is incredibly upsetting, obviously. And you can sense that sort of perseverance in this game, and just the stalkers eking out this life in the wasteland against all odds, right? So I don't want to be too dismissive in terms of, like, there's a lot of bugs and glitches. That doesn't bother me so much. Like, in a sense, people glitching out and sort of falling through the earth and spasming is like another expression of the zone, right? It's in a very meta way. So that doesn't bother me so much. There's some fundamental issues of just why am I here and how it's delivering the story that I don't completely get on board with. But just wandering the countryside, when the game's not throwing enemies at you, it's still just a beautiful space to wander in. Even just in how much this world is shades of brown and gray, there is an incredibly captivating sense of place to it.
That's very cool. Just one last question is, I know that you played sort of survival post-apocalyptic games like this. You were talking about a game like, you know, Fallout 76, you were playing a bit. You know, how does this game compare to that? I'm sure there are significant differences and some similarities.
Yeah, I mean, that was largely, Fallout 76 was largely about fulfilling quests and goals and achievements constantly, and seeing meters go up and constantly sending you UI pings here and there. Whereas this is a very sparse game, and just you have to want to explore for the sake of exploring, and just be in that space. Right? I mean, it does have a very similar sense of scrounging. Though surprisingly, I very quickly got to the point where I had more than enough ammo that I'd ever need, and I was constantly having to dump excess food and ammo in my stash because I had too much that I could carry. And so I'd heard people say that it's a game where you have to, like, pick up every bullet you find. I never really found that to be an issue. I'd like to have more sense that I was having to scavenge just to so it was more rewarding when I did find the bullets I need. And sort of encourage you to explore and dig around through all those stashes more, perhaps.
Very cool. Any more you want to talk about Stalker?
I think the other thing I was going to say earlier before we got on the tangent was one of the other form of mutants is these invisible mutants. And the game just has one trick in that regard. And it just keeps throwing these invisible mutants at you. And they're also bullet sponges. And so it's enough to get the drop on them and see you can see the shimmer, like the elites in Halo, for example. But just getting hit them once isn't enough. They'll still charge you and hit you. And the game just, now we'll throw you an invisible mutant in a enclosed corridor. Now we'll throw four invisible mutants at you. And I got a bit older that trick, I think. So hoping it has something new up its sleeves as I continue on. But I am still enjoying it so far.
All right. So the game I want to cover today is a game I beat within the last couple of weeks. I took it out from the library. It is a Nintendo Switch game. It's actually a game collection. This title is called Another Code Recollection, because it collects two separate games. These are graphical adventure games. The first was for the Nintendo DS, and the second was for the Wii. Now, you might not be familiar with these games by these names. Another Code, Two Memories for the DS. Another Code, R, A Journey into Lost Memories for the Wii. Primarily because they were called something different in the West.
The second game never was released in the West, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. I've certainly hadn't played it before. The first game was released as a title called Trace Memory for the Nintendo DS. And when I thought back on it, I did play it back in the day. I didn't make the connection initially. I think I learned about this game from a game trailer or something. And I thought, wow, that character design looks really familiar. This premise sounds really familiar. And lo and behold, it was connected to that original Trace Memory game, which I played a little bit of. I was reminded of how much of a sort of adventure game powerhouse the Nintendo DS was. There's so many titles I can think of, not the least of which is like the Professor Layton series.
Right, yeah.
There was a version of Myst. There was, I think it was called Hotel Dusk. Do you remember that one?
No.
It was like a kind of a noir detective story with, I think the character's name is Jake Hunter. And it is unique for having to play the title with the DS held sideways.
Oh.
So that instead
of a book, I guess?
Exactly.
Okay.
It opens up like a book.
Interesting.
And you tap on the right side of it.
Huh.
And then scenes happen on the left. Very, very innovative title. But suffice it to say, this is a genre I'm into. I played all forms of, and I liked very much on the DS. So I got this, and the game I found out is a budget title. It's about $60 Canadian at full retail price, so not hard to come by, and it does contain those two short adventure games. And you'll complete both games in about like 18, 20 hours easily.
Each and that's, or total?
Total.
Okay, right.
So the first game, I think I finished it in about 8 hours.
Nice.
And the thing that's interesting about this game is that it's almost all story. I would say that it's like a visual novel, but most visual novels have you making choices. This game does not have you make a lot of choices.
It's fairly linear.
It's quite linear.
Okay.
And I'm not going to write it off completely. There are a couple of points where you do make crucial decisions, but most of the time you're not. Most of the time you are sort of wandering, exploring, solving some really mild puzzles, and mostly like listening to cutscenes and talking to characters.
So you are moving around like a 3D space, right? I saw in the
trailer. Okay. That's right. You are in the original game. It was really interesting. I loaded up a ROM of Trace Memory because I just wanted to like remember what it was like, and it was so wild to kind of travel back in time to that period. So basically, how they use it is the bottom screen. You have the environment happen in 3D polygons, but it's shown from a top-down perspective. And then the 3D kind of swings around sometimes when there's a key moment, like focusing in on a puzzle. But for the most part, the 3D polygons are happening on one of the screens. And on the other screen, you have still images of what the main character, her name is Ashley in both games, is seeing with her eyes.
Interesting.
So you might be walking down a path, and then when you reach, an interesting moment, like there's a stone monument or something like that, the monument pops up on the top screen in front of you. You get to look at it a little
bit
more detail.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of those scenes you can tap in and zoom in even further. And as you might imagine, the DS version had a lot of that just kind of like tapping and touching BS that lots of DS games had, because that was the gimmick of the time. Thankfully, they've streamlined a lot of that in this version. There isn't much of anything that requires tapping or touching at all. There's a lot of rotating objects.
And actual puzzles, I saw, right?
There are certainly puzzles, and they fall under the typical variety. Some of them are like QTE-style button press combinations.
Looked very Resident Evil from what I saw.
Absolutely. If anything, I would call this game basically Resident Evil without zombies.
Yes, I got that impression.
You can ask yourself how excited that makes you. Most people would probably be turned off by that, but I bet there's just a few people in the listening audience.
There's a lot of schlock in Resident Evil that people love.
Yeah. Well, some people, there's a reason why there's puzzles in the Resident Evil games, right? Because some people absolutely adore them. And they add a different like pace and flavor to it, and it serves a similar function here. Yeah, so they seem to have kept the story largely the same. The characters are named the same. Their designs are pretty much the same, but they've spruced everything up, and the characters are in much more high-def polygons now, whereas they were like basically like still images in the previous game.
I saw that the dialogue was actually presented in these like comic frames too, which looked quite neat.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the original Trace Memory already looked like a comic because they used still picture frames and hand-drawn illustrations. But in this one, when it comes to a dialogue scene, sort of like a comic panel will come in from the sides, framing the main characters having dialogue with each other. And it does the sort of faux decision-making thing where, very much like, I guess, Mass Effect and other games do this, where you have dialogue with a character and they mention a keyword, and then the keyword becomes available as a speaking prompt for you at a later point.
Give me more information.
but it's not a real choice, because they'll tell you a keyword, there's a pause in their dialogue, and then there's one keyword that you can prompt.
Right.
So you didn't have to make a choice anyway. They could have just had a movie play out in front of you,
right,
and that would have served the same function. So that part I thought was somewhat weak.
Do they do anything interesting with that sort of framing device of the comics and the panels? Or is it just, is it read like, oh, this is a cost-cutting exercise?
No, I think it was a stylistic choice. Mm. And also in the DS game, basically like the prompt choices were on a separate screen.
Okay.
So they sort of had to make a mechanism by which to allow the player to choose. So basically the kind of the panel switches out, and then the text choices are displayed within. But I think overall the presentation is really well done. The characters are, you know, expressions are really, really dynamic. The main character, Ashley, is a really young kid in the first game. She's like, I think 13 years old. A day before turning 14 is what the story says. And both chapters all happen in one day. So the first chapter happens in one day. The second chapter happens 2 years later, but within the span of 24 hours. And she's quite a bit older in the second chapter. Basically, because it's a collection, they just treat it as one continual story. So the one game ends, there's a brief epilogue, and then 2 years later, and you're right into the next sequence. So it's quite seamless, and they do a pretty good job at it.
Is the story engaging?
The story is, I was really, you know, kind of a little bit conflicted with myself, asking, is this good? Am I enjoying myself? Is this worthy, quote unquote? Like, wouldn't I be enjoying myself more if I was watching like a HBO show or something like this right now? But I realized, like, this is serving a couple of different things for me. Is, you know, I like those puzzles. Like, I like to kind of have my brain tweaked a little bit while I play a game. I am actually one of the minority of people that probably enjoys those puzzles in the Resident Evil games more than shooting the zombies.
And there's also a mystery to it to unravel in the actual story, right?
Absolutely, there is. Like, there is in both Resident Evil and Another Code. And there's also the exploration factor, right? Like, the mansion in Resident Evil, or the police station, whatever you have it, becomes sort of a character. And that's very much the case with both these games as well. the first game in another code is set in a sort of a abandoned island, mysterious island, where things went down. There's a mansion here as well. And in the second game, it's sort of set at a summer camp sort of environment. Okay. So everything's very enclosed. There's only, you know, like 8 or 10 separate environments. You crisscross across those environments fairly closely. You go into rooms and then you explore all the corners of the rooms. It's pretty formulaic. But they have just enough of an intrigue to keep things going. First of all, I should warn people that, you know, there are some sensitive topics in this game. There's basically a murder in the first 30 seconds of the game. The main character, Ashley, loses both her parents and she's orphaned, essentially. She's raised by her aunt. And lo and behold, it turns out that your dad is still alive and he's on this mysterious island. That's the first 5 minutes of the game. Yeah. But absolutely, there's a mystery there. Is like, why did he stay out of touch? Mm. You know, why was your mom murdered? Who did it? Who is she working for? And there's a sort of like very Resident Evil / Umbrella Corporation reasoning behind it.
There are ghosts, apparently.
There are literal ghosts. There are fantastical elements. More so in the first game. Definitely in the first game. A little bit less in the second game. But there's sort of like a fantastic reality. it's anime logic, right?
Right.
It's clearly written by a Japanese team. But I'm sort of struck by games like Resident Evil. I'm comparing this game to Resident Evil a lot because they share a lot of qualities. When you have Japanese developers create games in largely American settings, they always have a unique sort of perspective on Americana. You know, like they really celebrate certain really
through the
like
looking glass
mundane details.
Yeah.
And they get a lot of things wrong and they sort of gloss over other details that other people would say, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Coca-Cola and Nike jeans everywhere.
Yeah. And it's really interesting though. It's like an American story, like, I don't know, Twin Peaks or something, but with like Japanese anime logic to it. So overall, I really enjoyed it. I like the main characters. Some of the side characters in the first game are enjoyable as well. The cast is much larger in the second one. I think there's only like 4 characters in the first game, 4 or 5 characters. In the second game, there's like a dozen or so. Mm. Second game is much larger in scope. There's more varied environments. There's sort of like a sci-fi twist to things. And more sort of leaps of logic going on. And the second game, I thought, got a little bit over the top in the melodrama. It sort of really went more into the storytelling part of it. And you'd have long segments without any puzzles at all.
It's teen drama, young adult fiction type things? Or
yeah, there's okay. So many. I don't know if these are direct inspirations, but it's like summer sleepaway camp. There's like, you know, kids want to win the rock and roll contest, the music band contest. There's like some Mean Girls type drama. There's like the old mysterious old lady who bears a grudge. And then there's the mysterious, you know, employer who you don't know whether they're they're looking out for your best interests of your dad or not. So a lot of twists and turns. Second game is a little bit slower to get up to speed. But overall, yeah, I enjoyed my experience with these games. You asked me if this is a good story or not, and I'm still trying to cycle around whether it is or not. I would say that no. Like, these are not great, impressive, earth-shattering narratives. And also, these are not, like, rock-solid, ingenious, you know, totally brain-racking puzzles either. There's not thrilling action. So everything about it is just kind of serviceable in mid.
Are the mystery elements, is that something that you're sort of engaged with solving yourself, or is it just being delivered to you? Like, are the answers just being given to you in a linear fashion, or do you have to like work to get those answers?
Here's the one thing I will say that is unique about this game and something that I thought was pretty effective. In both games, you will they're quite linear. You don't really have opportunities where you can go off the rails. For instance, if you have somewhere you have to go next and you walk past that trail, it'll say, oh, I better go back and talk to this guy because I promised I would help them with this thing. So it keeps you on the rail pretty closely. But after both stories resolve, so, you know, in reality, we're talking about two games here. At the resolution of each of the two games, there is a point where they ask you, why did this all happen? So it's one of the characters, maybe one of the main antagonists or the person that was the central subject matter of the overall sort of mystery says, well, why did it happen the way it did? And you have to provide an answer. And it's really like that's the most tense moment of each of the games because they give you like a half a dozen reasons behind it. And each of those reasons could be valid. Right? Each of those six reasons could be valid. I thought some of them were a bit of write-offs, like some far-fetched.
Is there a correct answer, though?
That's the thing. I don't know if there is a correct answer.
Okay.
So in both of the answers I gave, I had to think about a bit about them. And when I selected them, then the story sort of carried on and said, yes, that's right. It went down because this triggered that event. And then the whole charade crumbled. And so they had the wherewithal to really run with your input there. And probably what they did is they wrote it so that any of those answers would be valid.
Yeah.
But because they gave you a choice, that lets you put a spin on the story.
Sort of retroactively contextualizing your experience.
Yeah. So you kind of choose for yourself what was the most impactful aspect of the plot. So that I thought they did really well. That was unique. And I wish kind of games did more of that. I've been like, well, what was this all for? Because too often the game will tell you the answer and then you're just supposed to accept it. But this one, they ask you what the answer is. And of course you bring your own meaning to it.
This is like a little thematic debrief there.
Yeah. So I thought that was really effective.
Cool.
By the end of it, by the end of the second one, there's a bit of a epilogue, kind of like Harold Halibut, which we covered recently. Or another adventure game I played this past year called The Forgotten City.
Oh, yes. Yep.
In both games, there's a little bit of an epilogue where you can kind of say goodbye to the various cast members that you met throughout the course of the game. Because, you know, you're farewell. My character's moving along, going back, fading off into the sunset. So I won't see you again. So farewell. I hope the best for you. And you get to do that for everyone in the summer camp setting. And it's kind of touching, you know, because it makes you think, oh, I had a bit of an impact.
Gives you some closure.
Yeah. So that was a nice touch. So, yeah, that's what I'll say about both of the Another Code games is that they're kind of mid. Not really blowing you out of the water, but if you have a nostalgia for graphical adventure games, particularly those generation of graphical adventure games for the Nintendo DS, I think this will be a real treat because it sort of takes all of those games that were pretty rough around the edges and then polishes it to a nice new modern level.
Yeah, well, it sounds like very accessible and sort of as a good entry level to that genre with the remaster and the presentation. It's going to sort of ease you into it pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. This game is accessible is just the right word. It does not present you with a lot of friction. I don't know if I mentioned this, but there are a couple of helper modes. So there is a tool that will literally point an arrow at what you should do next. And then there's another element that I forget what it was. It just like points things out. So two sort of modes, additions that makes the what would be challenging even less challenging for you. So absolute easy mode. I disabled those two options because I wanted to have that a bit more of that retro feel. But I don't begrudge the fact that those, you know, usability tools are there. Anything that makes a story, a game more accessible to people, I think is great.
Yeah, and opens it up to a wider audience, for sure.
That's right.
Awesome. Okay.
That's another code recollection for Nintendo Switch.
Very cool. I saw there is a demo available for that too on Switch.
Yeah, cool. I think it's worth checking out.
Shall we jump into dessert then?
Absolutely. Let's talk about it. Why don't you start us off?
Yeah, so for dessert, we have a little non-gaming relating item that we've been enjoying. And in the interest of, I mean, I could easily have talked about another anime or manga that I've been enjoying lately. But in the interest of not making the whole nature of this segment, I'm going to talk about another murder mystery, jumping on from your theme there, that I've been watching the TV show Poker Face. So this is from Rian Johnson, who you may know from the Knives Out films, and potentially my favorite Star Wars film, The Last Jedi. So this is a murder mystery, sort of murder of the week type show. Came out a couple of years ago, but it wasn't consistently streaming in Canada. I just recently realized that the library had it, and so got the DVD from there. So it's starring Natasha Lyonne, who I know from Orange is the New Black. Others may know from Russian Doll, I guess. And so she plays Charlie Kale. It's a very Columbo type figure, I think, is the main archetype it's building on here. And there's a pretense of that she is basically on the run, and every episode she's in a new town with a new job and new friends. And also that she can basically know if you're lying or not. So it's a bit of a heightened reality in that she's got an instant lie detector, basically. And I think a few other shows have done that before too. I think Lie to Me was one. There's at least a few others. So you have to sort of suspend disbelief there. She knows lies. Curiously, the show always reveals the murder up front. Like every episode starts with like these little 10-minute short films. They could stand alone, to be honest. They're all very compelling of the murder taking place and all the lead up to that, basically. And they all have a pretty wide range of guest cameos. You've got Adrian Brody, you've got Tim Blake Nelson, Hong Chow was in one episode. Yeah, a really great lineup of various guest roles, and they're all only in one episode at a time, obviously. So I've really been enjoying that. It's got a very 70s vibe, I guess also riffing on Columbo. Everything's that sort of sepia tone, sort of color grading to it, and some of the cinematography here feels very 70s. And yeah, I never watched Columbo. I'm not sure if that's something you're familiar with, Mark, but this is scratching that itch that I didn't know I had.
Yeah, there was so many kind of detectives like that before the police procedurals kind of took over. You know, there's your Matlocks and things like that. Murder, She Wrote.
Yes.
Certainly of that generation. That was around a little bit probably too adult for me when I was younger, okay. But I certainly know what you're referring to. I'd never heard of this title, so that really interests me. I like Rian Johnson's works that you mentioned, and I like the performer Natasha Lyonne, but you know, my wife and I tried to watch Russian Doll, and we just didn't take to it.
Hmm.
Something about it.
I've been a while. So I've only seen the first season. I haven't caught the second one yet. I did enjoy that for what it's worth. But yeah, very, very, it's just a very fun cast lineup of people here. You have to suspend disbelief that every time she comes to this new town, she'll befriend someone, have them suddenly die inexplicably, and somehow she never feels cursed or like she's never a suspect in any way. There's this role with it. It does remind me a little bit of perhaps my favorite show is Pushing Daisies, which is something of a murder mystery of the week, but with like some like necromancy happening. That was a very high concept, high setting, like fairy tale world. Everything was very pastel colors. So that was very heightened. This is scaled back a little bit, mostly reality. But yeah, just a very, very, very fun scripts each episode there. Very like it's all weird settings. Like, oh, this murder happened in an old folks' home. This murder happened on a racetrack. So yeah, all good settings.
I kind of like how some shows, it sounds like this is one an example of that, are being allowed to be TV shows again, like throwback shows where you just like forget the unbelievability of it. Just get to the point. It's like, it's an episodic thing. You know, every show doesn't have to be a long sequence of movies that tie into each other with intricate plot points and overlapping themes.
Back when every season had 24 episodes and you had to have one where Deanna Troi is a cake.
That's right. You had a ton of stinkers, but and you had to write the stories so that you intentionally didn't know, you didn't have to know what happened last episode.
Exactly.
Because people are watching on television.
Every episode is its own little bubble, basically.
Yeah. So I like that.
Yep. And season two. That's returning. Season two of this, it was just announced with a even bigger lineup of guests that I'm very excited to check out. So, yeah, that's Poker Face.
Very cool. Well, you said that you forced yourself not to talk about anime, and now I'm going to talk about an anime.
Yes. Well, that's why.
I don't feel too bad, though. I talked about a film last week. So I'm going to be talking about a title that I just finished on Netflix. It's called Pluto. And Pluto is based on a cinematic universe that has existed for many years called, you might be more familiar with, called Astro Boy. So yeah. Astro Boy, Tetsuan Atom in Japanese, was a manga, was a TV show, multiple TV shows. And I think even another film in the West, like a kind of more DreamWorks style film a few years back in the West. But Pluto is a dark take on that world. So a lot of the same characters appear, Dr. Ochano Mizu, Adam, Astro Boy himself, his sister Uran, and all these other characters that feature in that Kitty show about a flying robot with boots, rocket boots, flies around in his red underwear. It's all the same characters. But the setting is decidedly much more dark, with pretty much like murder and death and dismemberment happening every episode in this one.
Yeah, I just watched the trailer. This has been on my radar for a while, but I just watched the trailer to refresh my memory. I hadn't realized this was actually Astrobot officially, but it gave me a lot of like Blade Runner vibes, that sort of gritty noir.
Yeah, is Astro Boy, by the way. Astrobot is Sony yes. video game. Yeah, and it definitely has neo-noir aspects to it. A large bulk of the episodes, of which I think there's only eight, it's 8 hour long episodes.
Oh, wow.
And a large bulk of them center around this character called Geschicht. He is a German robot, but he's a human form robot, so he's like a high human appearance.
He gave me like Ryan Gosling Blade Runner vibes.
Right. So, but everyone knows that he's a robot. Like right. That's not hidden information, that whether he's artificial or not. No, it's known that he's a robot. And in this universe, it's really interesting. Robots have rights. So robots can, you know, refuse their employers. They can adopt children. You are not allowed to destroy a robot because it's inhumane. So it brings up a lot of interesting topics, like what are the ethics of having robots in the military, weapons of mass destruction. In fact, there's this whole plot about a sort of ginned up war in the Middle East and weapons of mass robotic destruction. So it has a lot of real world overtones and a lot of deeper, more sci-fi themes to it, like those philosophies. You know, what is the ethics of artificial life? What is a life? What is a soul? And it covers so much different ground. So I'm having a hard time kind of pinning down like what exactly is at the core of this game, but it's of this series. It's absolutely fascinating, though. So there's aspects of police procedural. There's like some Dragon Ball style, superhero flying in the air action. There's Ghost in the Shell type military industrial complex stuff. Another content warning here. There's large aspects of war casualties, a lot of war dead. Large aspects of the series talk about orphans, child orphans, some of those orphans being robotic, but it goes all around and it's quite a roller coaster of a story. You really can't predict where the story will go. You think it's going to be quite stereotypical and quite very much like a police procedural, but some of the episodes are even like short films on their own. The basic premise of it is that advanced robots like Geschicht, like Adam, are being kind of targeted for murder by an unknown force. And so the detective has to track down what's the connection, who's causing this. And they do find out in the end. So well worth watching. I think it's just an excellent production. But don't go into this thinking it's going to be one thing or the other. It's really many, many things. And if you don't like clean answers or tight little ribbons tied on plots, you might not enjoy it.
I mean, is this one and done? Is there going to be more of this show?
I don't believe there can be more based on everything so that goes final. Down.
Okay, excellent.
But I should say that this is like very much not canon.
Mm.
Lots of things happen with the characters, lots of relationships. I don't really remember Astro Boy because I watched it when I was so young. But I am reading the manga series called Atom, The Beginning, which is talking about Dr. Tenma and Dr. Ochano Mizu in their youth, in their college days, before they create Astro Boy. So they have a very different relationship in that manga compared to what they do in this series. So basically, you can kind of call it like a parallel universe.
Okay. Because Astro Boy is pretty light tonally.
Very much so. He's like basically like Pinocchio, right? That's that's the whole gist of it is Astro Boy is Pinocchio. He's like his father's creation come to life because he just loved him so much and he can do no wrong, sort of, you know.
Cool.
So yeah, Pluto, worth watching.
I've been meaning to check it out for some time. I'll move it up the list. I know my anime book club was watching that quite recently.
Very cool. Go check it out.
Will do. Okay. Shall we close the book?
Absolutely. Yeah. Nice tight hour. We covered all the topics. I feel like we're coming into form with this new format.
Yes. Yeah. Enjoying this new format. So if you have any thoughts on any of the games or TV shows that we've discussed today, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club, or you can find us on Blue Sky.
That's right. And do check us out on YouTube as well. We post these episodes there every time that they go out. If you're not subscribed to the podcast, please subscribe there. Like, rate, leave comments everywhere that you can. We love to see the engagement and we'll try and respond to all the comments that you leave because it keeps us energized to produce more episodes.
Absolutely. And if any of you are going to be coming up to Vancouver for Terminal City Tabletop Convention, we'll both be there and hope to get in some games with everyone. Very much looking forward to that.
Absolutely. I got my tickets and I'm ready to go all weekend long. And it was March, 14th?
14th and 15th. So part of the half the Friday as well.
There you go. It's going to be an exciting weekend.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's start putting together a wish list of what we can get through.
Very good.
And in the meantime, remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks, y'all.
Bye.
Bye.